Hey everyone, and welcome to Scouting the League. It's draft week. For some of you, it's like Christmas is finally here. For others, perhaps a little bit of panic has started to set in. For me, it's a fun week where I fully expect all 32 teams to get better. Last week, we talked mock draft with Eric Edholm of NFL.com. Expect him to have probably a final mock draft out this week. Expect it to be mostly wrong, but either way, fun to talk about. Really fun conversation with him last week, and make sure you get back and listen to that one. This week, we're back on the team side, get some team perspective with Blake Bedingfield. We'll ask Blake about mock drafts, team perspective, players in the first round, a little bit of everything. Going to be a really fun conversation. First, let me remind you to like, subscribe, and share this podcast wherever you are listening. Give us a five-star review, leave us some comments. Most importantly, share this with a friend. If you are someone out there that knows somebody that needs to listen to this, a former agent, fellow agent, anything like that, make sure you share it. Get it out there, continue to get our numbers up. Joining us for the chat today, as always, he was a 1990 draft prospect out of Navy, a guy who worked hard for what he got, had all the intangibles, fell short of making that NFL mark. That is Neil Stratton. And if Neil didn't have a chance as a draft prospect, then neither did I. A 5'8" corner out of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Short, slow, stiff, white guy. Those are not the traits you want as a corner. Of course, I am Roderick David. And our guest, Blake, who would have surely and correctly had reject grades on both of us. A guy that was part of a 19 years in the NFL, roles all over the place with the Tennessee Titans, most recently the college scouting director. Again, good players that he drafted over the years, names that you know, Taylor Lewan, Marcus Mariota, Vince Young, Chris Johnson, Albert Haynesworth, Adam Pac-Man Jones, Jack Conklin, Javon Kearse, man, so many more good players that he was a part of. We'll get into all sorts of stuff today. So without further ado, Blake, welcome back to Scouting the League.
It's great to be on. It's a great week for football fans. Oh, I love it. It's fantastic. Can't wait.
Yeah, well, we won't even get into the draft reports, the scouting reports you would have done on Neil and I. They would have been scathing, but again, rightfully so. Again, all part of the process. Again, we're here to draft week, the culmination of all the work the college scouting department has done. You start travel in the fall, all-star games, combine, pro days, top 30 visits, private workouts, multiple rounds of meetings. Let's start from a college scouting director's standpoint. What does it mean to finally get to this week?
You know, this week is the kind of the culmination of an entire year for not only the scouting director, but the scouting staff, and all the work you put into the entire year comes into play this week. And it's an exciting time. It's a little bit daunting in terms of going through the meetings and shuffling the players up and down the board a little bit. But what happens this week, you start to get a little bit into some of the things that are out of the scout's control. That's the medical information, the off the field information that may take a player off the board, and you spend an entire year evaluating them, but something outside of the way they play the game could affect your grade on a player.
Did it really come in this late, Blake? Now the combine, correct me if I'm wrong, they get all the releases signed and then they run backgrounds in their college towns. Is that right? And then they deliver that information. Does it come in after the middle of April?
So what happens is it comes in throughout the entire process, all the information, whether it's medical or off the field issues, that comes in constant. The scouts go out and actually gather a lot of that information, but then the league, combine obviously, and different resources come in and put that information together. But what happens is when you start stacking the board,
Okay.
the talk about these players, the communication about these players ramps up, and it could affect a draft status. May not take a player off the board, but it may move them down the board a little bit to create that value for a player. So you may have a player that you grade in the second round, but because of a medical issue or an off the field issue, he may go down further in the draft where you can still have the player, but you understand where the value is now on that specific incident that he has or the medical situation. So the information's there. It's constantly coming in, especially some of the non-combine players, players that have taken a 30 visit, had a physical with one team. Usually all teams share that information throughout the league with all 32 teams. And we start to get that a little bit later because some of those 30 visits are late March, early April, and you're still gathering that type of info. Some of the off-the-field issues maybe have not been adjudicated in court, and they're still trying to play out that process. So you're digging that information out through your resources with the league people, the people that you've hired privately with your team that go out and try to acquire information on some legal matters as well. So that stuff is constantly being brought in, and that's why it can change the week of the draft.
All right, let me jump on ahead of Roderick on one more question. Rechecks are done, I think, 2 weeks ago. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ever recall, and Roderick, you can weigh in on this as well, do you ever recall information drastically changing on that recheck so much that it really moved a player on your board? And again, I realize at that point maybe your boards weren't final, but did it ever make that much of an impact on a player that you're like, man, I didn't expect that kind of information?
You know, usually in more in a positive manner, because what happens coming out of the combine, you get the negative. So let's just say an ACL tear that has not progressed at that point to where you want it. But because of the way science has really developed over the years, those things started to, in that month period from the combine to the rechecks, the players started to look much better. Players started to look stronger. The expectations on the player went from mid-season to maybe right before training camp. Well, that creates the value of the player goes up a little bit. So, yeah, the rechecks can have more of a positive impact on a player than a negative at this point.
Yeah. Roderick, would you go along with that?
Yeah, again, those are the situations I remember are on the positive side where, again, a team, you know, or this group of scouts, whatever it was, likes a player, but that medical's hanging out there and everybody's kind of, you know, sitting on pins and needles, hoping that recheck comes back in a way, because again, you've got a player probably slotted where you would like to take him, and you're just waiting for that medical recheck. And again, it comes in positive, man. Everybody feels good about it. Hey, we're going to get this player where we think he deserves to go, and feel really good about it. So definitely on the positive side with it. Again, you throw in the COVID year, the COVID became really crazy for some of the medical rechecks, and it was really just medical in general. Again, you think about the difference that year and again, the whole situation created. I know there were some players in those years where I remember one specific player, the Wednesday of the draft, we finally got some recheck, final check information that kind of set his final grade. But again, that was maybe a unique situation with where we were in the world with COVID.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I want to get one more question in that I asked Eric last week, and I'd love to get your take on this, Blake. Which player is a bigger risk based on what you know of this draft class? Amarius Mims, the Georgia tackle, because of his lack of experience, or Laiatu Tuilotu because of his medical history?
You know, that's a great question. And offensive linemen, I love to have a lot of experience. And that concerns me because, you know, you see kind of a small snapshot of the player. You see the huge size, the great physical stature, the ability, and you want to kind of imagine him being a great player, but what kept him off the field? I remember watching him 2 years ago, and you would have to hunt and pick, try to find his plays, and you saw the ability without question whenever you watched him, but just wasn't enough. I worry more about the lack of experience in a player, especially at that position too. The medical is a situation where you have a history of it and a track record of it. But again, you're looking at this player as a four-year player. Okay. Can you get 4 years out of this player? If you get five, that's great. If you get seven, wonderful. But really you're looking at this player in a 3 to 4 year window of, can he produce on the field in that window that you're looking at, that 3 to 4 years. So if the medical comes back and says, hey, he can do that over that period, but he's not going to have longevity in the league, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. And Roderick, I don't mean to walk all over you, but I mean, this topic fascinates me. One more question. How many you know how many teams are good at developing specific positions and what have you, Blake. How many realistically teams do you think could develop Mims into the kind of player? How many O-line coaches are out there that could pull out of him what he has versus how many he'd really be kind of be on his own to develop?
You know, the two stick out in my mind right off the bat, and there's a track record of success with those coaches. You look in Philadelphia right now, what they did with their left tackle. No experience, turned him to an all-star left tackle. The Titans with Callahan, he comes in, he has a great track record of success with players, developing players, kind of in not only just enhancing their abilities, but really getting a lot out of them. I think the Titans and the Eagles just stick out to me right off the bat, the Cowboys being another one that can develop players that really didn't have high ceilings, even though Mims has a high ceiling. But those are the ones that I really, really look at. But I would say a little bit more than half the league. You know, I think coaching, getting off subject a little bit, but staying within this topic, coaching has changed in the NFL from developing and really enhancing skills. They're more of a scheme-oriented coaches now, but offensive line coaches are the ones that are still developers, still teachers. Those usually defensive line and offensive line still have that ability to teach and develop players, where some of the other positions, you better be more ready-made because you're probably not going to get that development on the NFL level.
Like, the Tennessee Titans, again, it's you've got a coach there in Coach Callahan that, again, he is highly respected, really good at what he does. But from an organization standpoint, you just go back a couple of years to another Georgia tackle they took that did not turn out well, of course, in Isaiah Wilson. How much does that factor in when you've got really – it's mostly a new building, but again, the owner's still there, and you've got that every member of the media is going to point back to if you end up taking Mims somewhere. How much does that type of thinking play in as, again, you're sitting there talking with the big bosses about who we're going to take here, and can we even take Mims here?
I think that's a great question, because I think the owner, if you had a very strong owner, if you had a Jerry Jones type owner, whether you had new coaches, a new GM, so to speak, underneath you, you may shy away from a player like that because of past experiences like an Isaiah Wilson. But in that building, you have an owner that really allows their front office and coaching staff to kind of do what they want to do. I don't think the Rand Carthen and Callahan, Coach Callahan, are going to worry about that as much as if that coaching staff was still there, Mike Vrabel was still there and had that issue before, because you may shy away from that player and take someone of similar abilities. But I think that's a great question. And I think more owners are involved these days in the building with the draft. They're wanting to know. And those questions, you know, are going to come up when you have such a failure like an Isaiah Wilson.
Yeah. And again, it may not always be the, the front end of the player, but again, we better have a plan to address it with the media, because you know those questions are going to be there from the outset. So again, having that plan in place. Again, Blake, we had Eric at home. We talked mock draft last week. How much, if any, are you paying attention to, again, mock drafts, consensus grades, what the media is saying about where these players are going out there come draft week?
You know, I always paid attention to the mock drafts that have connections in the NFL, that use connections, okay? Daniel Jeremiah, scout in the league. I'm going to look at his mock draft. Why? Because he's got connections, definitely with the Chargers. He does a lot of play-by-play for them. Mel Kiper, he uses the Baltimore Ravens facility to do a lot of his live shots. He has connections in the building. Bucky Brooks was a scout in the NFL. I'm going to look at some of those guys that have connections in the front offices, and I'm going to look at their mock drafts a little bit stronger than I would somebody that just doesn't have as many connections, or that I perceive doesn't have as many connections. So I like looking at them. Even as a scout, I love the process. I love the information. I would listen to podcasts and radio shows. I would gather as much information as possible. Something may slip out that may be of interest. But to me, as much as I worked in that business for 19 years, it's a hobby as well. I love it. My wife always said it was a hobby that I got paid for. And I agree. It was. I never felt like I worked a day in my life in 19 years. So it's fun. And so I always looked at them. But I would definitely pay attention to certain ones for sure.
Yeah, information is king. Again, the more information you have, again, kept in the proper perspective, as always, is the biggest thing. Before we jump into some specific kind of top five talk, any big misconceptions? Again, you're always going to, as a college director, as a scout, you always get the question, hey, you know, what's it really like? What, you know, what are you guys actually doing? Biggest misconceptions, or again, things that the maybe average or even avid fan out there going into draft week just does not think about in terms of what a team is really doing this week.
You know, I think the biggest misconception is that there's constant trade talk. You're talking to all 32 teams constantly and trying to work out deals. That just doesn't happen. You're making initial phone calls, trying to see if you wanted to move up or move down, you know, where some landing spots may be. But there isn't this constant trade conversation that's going on all the time, especially when you're talking about if you're in the mid rounds of the first round. If you're at the top, you may have a few more conversations because it's right on the beginning of the draft. But I think that's one of them. That's a big one. I think that the constant leading up to the draft, there's more downtime. You know, I know the day before the draft, I always sent all the scouts off to a golf and let them enjoy it. You know, go golfing for the afternoon. Basically, the hay's in the barn at that point. The day before the draft, everything is wrapped up. Maybe there's some few conversations with the coach and GM and director, that type of thing. But for the most part, it's done. So that day before the draft was really quiet.
It used to be the prime workout time. You'd see, you know, scouts, coaches that Thursday morning of the draft, some of the best workouts these guys ever got. Cause as you said, the hay was in the barn. Again, some of that stress melting off and, you know, you can see him getting that work in. So let's stop and dive into the top five. Again, we're expecting quarterbacks to go 1, 2, 3 this year. You were a part of drafts that took Vince Young at 3, Jake Locker at 8, Marcus Mariota at 2. When you're drafting with a quarterback in mind that early, when do you feel like you are set? At what point are you like, hey, this is the way we think it's going to go in front of us, and this is our guy?
You know, I think with each one of those situations, it was unique. Basically with Vince Young, we had a coaching staff, Jeff Fisher. We needed a young quarterback. We had coached the Senior Bowl that year. We coached Jay Cutler. There was a connection with Norm Chow, our offensive coordinator, with Matt Leinart. And then Vince Young, and I think the story's been out there in the public for a long time. Mr. Adams, the owner of the Titans, really wanted Vince Young. And that's kind of the first time I remember in my time, and really the only time that he had a major influence on the selection of that pick. So you kind of waited, kind of take that player, whether the organization was going to go in a different direction or not. You know, that's when the owner comes down with a statement and says, this is your player, you're going to take him. And so at that point, you sit there and go, okay, he's our guy. What do you do? And Norm Chow was the offense coordinator, and Norm Chow did a phenomenal job with Vince Young, creating a system and allowing him to use his unique skill set. And he ended up being Rookie of the Year in his first year and showed a lot of promise. Year two, had some success. Year three, fired Norm Chow, hired Mike Heimerdinger, who was an excellent offensive coordinator from previous days with the Titans, but probably not the same, not the right fit for a person like Vince Young. Definitely tougher, harder on the quarterback, not a good fit. Going to Marcus Mariota, you had Jameis Winston go number one. Marcus was 2. We're sitting at 2. We would have taken either player at that point. Comfortable with both. Marcus was our preference. The key to Marcus at that point was don't change systems. You know, have a system in place. Don't change it. Don't change coaches. Put players around him and allow him to be successful. And I think as an organization, we did not do a good job of either one of those. With Jake Locker, it was a different coach. It was Mike Munchak was our head coach, and Mike Munchak's personality was run first, toughness, came coached in a system with the Titans with Steve McNair. He saw a lot of the same physical attributes, same leadership, same toughness, that type of thing. And Jake just showed all those skills. The one thing Jake couldn't do was stay healthy, similar to what when at the University of Washington. Always had something, whether it was a shoulder, broken wrist, a hip sublux, you know, very serious injuries. But he was tough. He was a worker. He had that ability to be that leader. He just couldn't stay on the field enough. And I hate that for him because he was such a quality person. But those three things, it's unique situations when we took them, all three different head coaches, different GMs, and reasons why we took them were so different. And I'm so glad to be a part of that process and watch it all play out that way.
Like, sounds, I think you just answered this question, but based on having scouted those guys, evaluated them, did they turn out to be the players you expected them to be based on what you knew going into the draft?
You know, Vince, I would say yes. Vince did. He had a lot of success. Vince was a player that you needed to have a lot of positive reinforcement around him, put certain players around him, and you could have success. We had Chris Johnson. We had some other skilled players that really kind of highlighted his skill set, which was good. I think with Marcus, no, we didn't put the players around him to have success. And I don't think we ever got the best out of Marcus. Marcus was an outstanding worker, really good athlete, a very smart, cerebral type player. The problem is we kept changing systems on him. We confused him. If you look at the history of kind of the NFL quarterbacks a lot, look at some of the most productive quarterbacks in the last, you can say, 15 years. Tom Brady didn't start as a rookie, sat. Patrick Mahomes didn't start as a rookie, sat. Aaron Rodgers obviously didn't play for the first 3 years. Even his replacement, Jordan Love, didn't play. And Jordan started to have that success. They were able to kind of grow into their systems, not having a lot of coaching changes. Tom Brady didn't have an offensive coordinator and head coach had changed until he left and went to Tampa Bay. You look at Kansas City, Andy Reid still calling the plays. That cohesiveness, that stability can really make somebody have success. I think a lot of the bust on the quarterback level, and I'm kind of expounding on your question there, but I think a lot of bust are created not by the player busting, but the organization busting around them, in my opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Blake, you use the term system, right? Again, and it used to be more of a dirty word. Hey, this guy's a system quarterback. Well, yeah, everybody's a system quarterback in whatever system they came from. One of the things that now has changed is we have seen more, you know, perhaps more, you know, variation in the types of quarterbacks. So you've got a Jaden Daniels, you've got a Lamar Jackson. Very different type of system for those players than Patrick Mahomes, than Aaron Rodgers, than Tom Brady. Again, system is all about taking the player's strengths and what they do best. And again, you talk about your coordinators. Again, you've got Vince Young, Jay Glocker, Marcus Mariota. Again, all different systems. But again, having that cohesiveness and system and some translation from their college days. Again, you see it with, again, Cliff Kingsbury being in Washington this year. Is what, you know, quote unquote, system are they going to be running? Is it what Kyler Murray was doing? Was it what he was trying to implement while he was in college? Again, system quarterback doesn't mean he is limited to a system. But again, to get the most out of those quarterbacks and really any player, you got to put them in the right spot. How did, again, you evaluate that? Again, it's tough. You know your quarterback, you know your quarterback coach, your offensive coordinator. But again, the system, how much talk was, hey, this guy is going to be the best in our system?
Not enough. And I think that's a great question. Not enough conversation with that. Because if you get a coach that is very strong in what he does, I thought Norm Chow, I kept going back to Norm, kind of altered what he did all his years at BYU, Utah, and USC. As a great college, collegiate offensive coordinator, kind of changed his system to fit Vince Young's. So, yes, he did a very good job. But I think as we took other quarterbacks, that change, it was my system and he's going to fit into it. But that's a potential failure for a quarterback, okay? You're taking a quarterback because of the success and the production that they had on the collegiate level. Start to infuse some of that system. Maybe change as they get older and they grow and have experience in the league. But give them immediate success. I look at not only the system, Roderick, but I also look at some of the players. If I'm a player coming out, if I'm a quarterback coming out this year, I'm looking at the Bears system going, yes, I'll take it. Look at the offensive personnel they've now built up around them, not only from the offensive line, but the receiver position, tight end position. Look at the Washington Commanders. I got Terry McLaurin. I got Dotson. I like that. I even want to go to the Vikings before I go to the Patriots. I want to throw to Justin Jefferson. I want to throw to those players. Those players have a better chance to have immediate success than someone that's going to go to New England without any playmakers around him. Look at Bryce Young last year with the Carolina Panthers. Very few playmakers around him. He had an awful year, and his trajectory is not very good because what have they done? Fired the head coach, have a new offense coordinator. He's in year two, changed the complete system on him. He's on a trajectory of probably not having the career that he was going to have when he came out because of already the moves that the organization has made.
Yeah.
Oh, that's Blake, speaking of systems, and this has always been something that's kind of fascinated me. Matt Leinart didn't have the career I don't think anyone expected him to have based on the success he had at SC. Had he gone to the Titans, had he gone to an offense that he was very familiar with, do you think he has a different career from the one he wound up having?
Yes. And the reason I say that is it was put out there in a really elaborate way by Norm Chow saying, I need a speed running back. I need a big X receiver. And that's what he had. And Mike Williams and Reggie Bush to go along with Matt Leinart. And he said, I need those players for him to have the ultimate success. So the blueprint was out there of what he needs and what that player needs. Because he's not – I didn't think Matt Leinart was a franchise-level quarterback, meaning everyone around is going to be better because he shows up on the field. He needs those players around him to have the ultimate success. And I don't think he was put into that position early in his career, and he ended up taking a lot of hits and not really surviving in the league. But that's, I think that's the, having that blueprint, what players around, not necessarily the quarterback, what he needs, but what players around, what does the offense coordinator need to be able to call plays to make that player successful? Because unless you're a franchise quarterback, which I think there's only just a few in the league, and I mean true franchise quarterbacks, you need to have a strong playmaking unit around them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that brings up a whole different conversation we won't get into today. But I know Neil may be the biggest advocate for your head coach needs to be the offensive coordinator and really quarterback speaker. Because, again, you see the Texans, you could say, were remarkably fortunate to keep Slowik as the OC. Because, again, with what C.J. Stroud did, you want to keep that continuity together. Again, all of a sudden you look at a Patriots situation where, again, they draft a quarterback high and is really successful. You may lose your OC in a year. Again, Washington, will Cliff Kingsbury get a chance again? I don't know. If they draft somebody at two and they absolutely, shred the league on offense, again, he's going to at least get interviews. Again, you see it up in Detroit where these – big time offensive coordinators, again, you've got to set them up for success. And it can be really hard when that head guy's a defensive coordinator, knowing that OC is going to likely get his chance. Again, Neil and I have talked about that. Blake, any thoughts on that before we move on?
I agree 100%. I think the head coach, offense coordinator, I mean, Andy Reid's a great example. But even in Houston, when you have a leader as a head coach like DeMeco Ryans, you almost need to pay your offense coordinator like a head coach to keep him around. Just like Neil said, to have that continuity, to have that system. And maybe Slowik wants to be a head coach at some point. But if you can pay him like a head coach, which every organization can to keep someone like that around, especially during the first 3 to 4 years of your quarterback's career, would be huge. And I think paying them is really important if you have a defensive head coach kind of like a DeMeco Ryans, who seems to be outstanding in that role. So unless you can have the offense coordinator, but Roderick, you're right, they're going to get interviews every year. Look at what the Titans did with Callahan. He didn't even call plays in Cincinnati. This will be the first time he's been a head coach and play caller in the NFL, and he's going to do it in year one as his head coach. So but he was in a system that had success. His tree was under a lot of head coaches with a lot of success calling plays, and that's what the Titans are looking for just in that situation.
Yeah, definitely a football guy. He's been around it for a bit. He's got some good bloodline. So there, again, so we are, again, is there any reason we should talk about Caleb Williams not going number one to the Chicago Bears? That's a done deal, right, Blake?
I think it's a done deal. I have questions on Caleb. And I think it's more of, you know, if I would love to have been a scout this year and gone into USC and really dived into him as a person. I saw some things on the sidelines. I saw some things during games that really brought up a lot of questions, you know, and is his mannerisms, is his leadership, is his ability to fight through adversity going to be there? I'm not quite sure. And that's just on the outside looking in. I wish I was more inside that glass and knew that answer, but there were some major questions that I saw watching him play this year. Physically can play. He's an improviser. He's a playmaker. He's a point guard. He can distribute. No question about that. My things are more of off the field, and are those going to be a concern? And he's going to a city with high expectations,
yep,
and that had success in football for a long time. It could be a tough place to go. You know, he would probably have been better served to go to a smaller type city, but hopefully he has success. I would take him too, if all the background checked out.
Yeah.
Let me, you know, you mentioned earlier, Blake, that y'all had Jameis and Mariota kind of equal. You would have taken, you know, whichever one fell to you. I think to some degree, Jameis has some of the same issues, some of the same questions. There was the crab legs, but there was also other, I think, things that came up along long way that were off the field. How did you dig into Jameis in a way that you were satisfied that, you know, the character issues, the leadership issues, you know, all those questions were answered? How would that be similar to how you would treat a Caleb Williams if you're in those shoes?
You know, I probably spend as much time on Jameis Winston as I have with any player. And I'm talking about background. You know, from once you evaluated him and said, yes, he can play in the NFL, he can be a starter. Again, don't change systems, all that kind of stuff. I talked to everyone from his high school coach. I talked to a counselor at high school. He was drafted twice in the MLB. I talked to four MLB general managers about him that had did work on him. Called them to find out. I didn't care what kind of baseball prospect he was. I wanted to know what they knew. Okay. I talked to everybody at Florida State, obviously. And when you talk to people, you don't just talk to the coaches who want him to be successful. I talked to the secretaries that have been there 25 years. I talked to, you know, trainers and equipment guys. I talked to different people at that school. I spent an enormous amount of time with Jameis, and I grew to really like the guy. And I really did, because on the outside looking in, you had an opinion. But once you got to know him, he's very charismatic and a very likable person. What I found was he was an extremely competitive person. I'm going to tell this quick story. I'm going to try to make it quick. We went to dinner the night before he came in for the 30 visit. He, myself, head coach, general manager, offensive coordinator, went to dinner out at this restaurant. He walks in the restaurant. He shook hands with everybody in the whole restaurant. I mean, he was taking pictures. He was doing everything. Went to a private room, sat and ate. He ordered a huge steak, right? This enormous steak. Started to eat it. Ate about half. And he's looking at me the whole time while he's doing that. And I have the same steak and I'm eating mine. And he's competing with me the whole time. How much water I drank, how much of the steak I ate. And he goes, I've eaten more than you. I've had three glasses of water. You've only had one. And I'm like, what is he doing? I'm not trying to compete. I'm 45 years old and I'm really not trying to compete with you. But anyway, he's doing this. And as the night ends, he wants a to-go box for his steak. And on the way out, I said, hey, because Marcus Mariota was in that same draft and we had taken him out to the same restaurant a week before. I said, you know, you didn't eat your steak. I said, Marcus ate the whole thing. He said, y'all sit back down. I'm going to eat the whole thing. And he ate the whole steak. We had to sit there another 30 minutes because he was not going to let Marcus beat him on eating a steak. That's how competitive this guy was. Leaving the restaurant, he goes behind the counter where they were cooking, sat with the cook, took pictures with everybody. I mean, he was just a big personality, and I really grew to like him at that point.
Yeah.
Do you think that was for y'all, Blake? I mean, how much of that was genuine? How much was that trying to really go the extra mile to impress y'all?
I don't think he was trying to impress. He was kind of lagging behind because he wasn't even looking at us to see if we were watching him. I was kind of keeping up with him just to make sure he would get to the right spot and all that. But I just think that's who he was. He was doing that in the building. When he came to the building, he'd stop and chat with anybody. I think he's just a very charismatic, talkative type person. He texted me a million times leading up to the draft, just, you know, chatting back and forth. And we had the second pick. We didn't have the first pick. So, you know, he didn't have to do that. But
I mean, you look at, regardless of what Jameis Winston's on-field football career has become, the dude could have a camera follow him around and be a reality TV show, because he is all those things: entertaining, competitive, again, a player's guy. Again, you saw it maybe rear its head in a different way for the Saints late this year with that extra touchdown against the Falcons. But again, the guy is, again, all those things. And again, on-field success, off-field success, again, who he is as a person, that's all part of the package. And again, one of those things that when you're evaluating players, again, you're getting a player, and there is a certain amount of developing as a person, developing as a player. But again, some of these guys are 20, 21, 22. They are who they are, and they are going to be who they are. So again, don't try to change them. Don't try to change a system. Don't try to change a leader. Don't try to change a person. You better put that, again, system of leadership, system of offense, whatever it is, have it in place and allow them to, you know, capitalize on all the strengths and everything that they bring to the table. Again, Jameis Winston's going to make a lot of pretty plays. He's also going to throw 30 picks. Again, that's going to be part of his game. And again, part of why he is a backup quarterback at this point that a bunch of teams are lined up to have on their roster. So, again, that's maybe a player that we don't need to focus on today. So we've got Caleb at one. Again, the question now becomes two and three, right? We are expecting it'd be a shock if it's not quarterback at two and at three. You've got Washington sitting there at two. You've got the Patriots at three. You've really got, let's say, three quarterbacks who are going to be part of the conversation. Jaden Daniels, LSU. You've got Drake May, North Carolina. You've got J.J. McCarthy from Michigan. Blake, have you looked at those guys enough to have a good feel for your personal evaluation and then maybe what you think these teams are considering and where they'll go?
You know, I love Drake May. I think Drake May is going to be a really good quarterback. And if he goes to Washington at two, again, with the players that they have around, it's going to be some immediate success. And I don't think they have all the players around him yet, but they have a nice group around to where he can have some success early. I think he has the size. I think he has the arm strength. I think he has the athleticism. I think there's another level of his game that he hasn't reached yet. I think going to a system with Dotson and McLaurin, and, you know, they even have Zach Ertz that they brought in, a kind of a stable player, Austin Eckler that they got from the Chargers, still have Brian Robinson, the running back. That's a nice group. I don't think they have the offensive line yet that you would want to have in front of him. That's what they're going to have to build after selecting that quarterback. But I really like Drake May. I think when it's all said and done, I think Drake May can be a top 10 quarterback in the NFL at his peak. And if you're selecting that with a second overall pick, I think that's a pretty good one. But I think he has everything you want. And my research on him, very smart mentally, off the charts as well. I think he's going to be a really good player. If you watch him in games, without a great supporting cast on offense at North Carolina, extremely competitive player as well. Love that about him, and really all the quarterbacks. There is a competitive level. Jaden Daniels has it as well. J.J. McCarthy for sure. But Drake May is my second favorite. I would go Jaden Daniels third. The one concern I have about Jaden, and he has made as much progress from his first couple of years in the league, and I remember evaluating him then to now, he's made a huge transformation. The athleticism was always there, the running ability. My one worry with him, and it's not going to get better in the NFL, is he takes too many hits. I was at the Alabama-LSU game this year live. He got knocked out of that game. He couldn't stay on the field, and it was because he kept getting hit. He was doing great things when he was on the field, but he got hit, and they ended up losing the game because the backup quarterback came in, and they kind of smothered him. But he just takes too many hits, and you see that in game after game after game, and he has a very slight frame, and part of his game is his running ability and ability to get downfield with his feet, and that's not going to get better when you can't avoid hits. I don't see that improve very much on the NFL level. My fourth quarterback is J.J. McCarthy, and I think he has another level of play when he enters the NFL. I like him in competitive competitive situations. You look at him in last minute drives. You look at him in big game type situations. He performs not only with his arm but his legs. I think he has another level that hasn't been reached yet, and I think he's going to be a very good pro. Don't think he's going to be, you know, a top quarterback in the league, but I think he can be in that top 15 range and be a winning type quarterback. And then you kind of work your way down, you know, into the Michael Penix, who I like in a certain system. We talked about systems, and then probably Bo Nix after that.
Yeah.
Do you think that, I mean, I don't know how well you know Kingsbury, Blake. Can he be the kind of guy like a Norm Chow who will adapt his system, or is he going to try to say, okay, square peg, round hole, I don't care. This is how we win, and this is how you're going to have to play if you're going to be in my offense?
You know, Kingsbury was a different as he's been different as a head coach and coordinator. I think as a coordinator, he's much better at kind of fitting what the team, what the player needs. And then as a head coach, it's kind of fitting what I need. And he hasn't had success as a head coach. He didn't have it at Texas Tech. He didn't have it with Arizona. But as an offensive coordinator, he's had a lot of success. And you start to see the difference in the personality in those positions. You know, that has to be a huge thing, because otherwise you're going to flip that and probably go Jaden Daniels over a Drake May. But you have the potential to really be passing up an outstanding quarterback in May if you let that happen, if you let that change. But, you know, I'm not, I can't answer that, Neil. I think that's an interesting question, but I think he's had a lot more success. His quarterbacks have had a lot more success when he was the OC compared to a head coach.
Do you think Daniels, you mentioned the frame. I think Daniels is 21. Could he grow into that where he, I mean, I remember when I was 21, I was still a little slight. And, but you know, the older you get, obviously the thicker you get. I mean, could he get to a point where he grows into that a little bit more? Maybe isn't as brittle.
You know, I think Drew Brees is a great example of a body that when he came out of Purdue wasn't huge, but you look at Drew and you look at the Bryce Youngs and you look at Jaden Daniels, you know, they're kind of a slight frame anyway. You know, Drew got more muscular. He started to put on more of the muscle on his frame, which added a little bit to him. I'm not quite sure Jaden has that. He's real, real lean, real thin in the arms and the legs. I'm not sure there's a lot of room to put on muscle. There's just not that much to give. You know, just I think it's going to be tough. I think he is what he is. I think Bryce Young is kind of what he is in terms of his frame. I just don't think there's a lot of potential for bigger. You just better be able to avoid hits and just not take as many shots.
So before we get out of the top five, you've got J.J. McCarthy as your fourth overall quarterback, and you've got teams at both 4 and 5 who have been prime trade down candidates kind of all through this process in Arizona and the Chargers. Do you think there's a team out there that, you know, hey, JJ's there at 4 or 5, all of a sudden the value comes down a little bit in terms of what I give up, that a team jumps up there for him? Is there enough there with JJ? I'm a little lower on JJ than I think the, you know, kind of the consensus. But do you think that's a spot for him that he ends up there?
Absolutely. I think that a team, if you're the Vikings, if you're the Broncos, if you're the Raiders, you got to have a quarterback. And are you comfortable with Penix? Are you comfortable with Bo Nix? Those players over at JJ McCarthy? Because I think the Giants are in a spot where they may have to take JJ McCarthy. I look at it not only from a team perspective. Daniel Jones has had his time, and they haven't won enough ball games with him. And Joe Shane is kind of in that situation as a GM and Brian Daboll as a head coach, where it's now time. You better start winning, or your time there may not be long. Can they reset their clock with a new quarterback? Can they do that? There's potential of that pick there with the Giants. But if you're the Vikings, you have Sam Darnold right now as your penciled in starting quarterback. It may be time to move up and acquire a player. The Broncos, they don't have that player either. Anyway, yes, I think that is a prime spot. But if you're the Arizona Cardinals and you have the chance to take a Marvin Harrison Jr., you passed last year, you traded down to get out of the top pick and all that kind of stuff with the Houston Texans. It's now time to take some blue chip type players. It's time to start adding those type players. Quantity is good, but you better start getting some quality on your roster. And passing up on a Marvin Harrison Jr., unless you can just move down a couple of spots, would be hard to do.
Yeah.
Like, does it concern you that Marvin Harrison Jr. basically said, I'm not going to play by y'all's rules on running a 40, working out, pro day, all those kind of things? I mean, is that an issue at all, or do you just kind of give him a pass because he's a premium player?
I don't think anybody's above that. You know, in my opinion, I think you have to – I think that concerns you. And I would have to dig into that, you know, really deep to find out what kind of player that is, what kind of kid that is, to pass up on all those situations. Are you really comfortable with this person? Obviously, the talent speaks for itself. But can you get a player of likability, similar ability, maybe not at the top level, but likability, and be more comfortable with a person? There's a lot of potential. There's a lot of potential in that. If that was me, if I'm not comfortable with the person, so
Again, quarterbacks move the needle. Got to have a quarterback. If you're a team that is in that top spot, you got to get your quarterback while you're up there. But you got to draft starters in the first round. Let's get through again these top three or four picks. You're sitting there anywhere four through about 10. Again, you drafted some really good players in that range, guys that are, again, cornerstones, your left tackles, your premier rushers. If you're sitting there four through 10, and let's say this year's draft, again, maybe a value player, a Marvin Harrison Jr., again, the first defensive player may not go till pick 8 or 9 this year. Again, your first offensive tackle may not go till about 8 or 9 this year. If you're sitting there and you've got your quarterback locked up and you can, you know, kind of wait it out and get a good player, how are you kind of gleaning through your board and kind of waiting to see where it goes? What are the big considerations? And again, how hard is it to sit there and stay patient when that, again, Malik Nabers, Marvin Harrison Jr. is on the board and you're just dying for one of those guys to fall to you?
You know, I think that's where the experience in the draft room really comes into play. Is a lot of these situations this year, I think, is a unique year. A lot of teams have put themselves in a position where they must take need players. Okay. A lot of the quarterbacks, I mean, for example, Bears don't have one. They got to take a quarterback. The Patriots don't have one. They got to take a quarterback. The Commanders don't have one. They got to take a quarterback. I mean, you look at some of these, they force themselves by not doing anything in free agency where they must. You look at the Chargers, for example, they got rid of Austin Eckler, Mike Williams, and Keenan Allen. They got to have playmakers for Justin Herbert. I mean, this is a quarterback that should be in his prime years, should be taken off to that next level. Are you going to take an offensive lineman when you just gave up your three best offensive playmakers? You better get a playmaker. And so to answer your question, I think you're sitting there at that spot with the Chargers saying, I've got to have a playmaker. I can't take an offensive lineman. I know that's been projected in a lot of mock drafts, but you better take some playmakers to put around that quarterback, or you're going to have some wasted years on Justin Herbert. But I think that Arizona Cardinals, again, you got Kyler Murray. He's signed to a long-term contract. Whether you like him or not, that's Monty Austin Fort's guy. That's the head coach. That's your guy because of the contract. You better put some players around him to give him some success in that top 10 round. You know, I think when you talk about the best defense player on the board, I think there's some different opinions on who that may be. I don't think there's an elite level players after some of the quarterbacks, after Marvin Harrison Jr. I think you got some good players. I think Nabers is going to be a really good player. I think Joe Alt could be a solid player. I don't think he's an elite tackle. I don't think any of the other tackles, but you can get that solid starting piece in that top 10, maybe not the Pro Bowler or the elite level all-star type player, but you can get a really good player by sticking. But I think the further you get out of that draft, the down the first round of the draft, I think the talent starts to weaken a little bit, and you better sit in there in that top 15 and take that player if you're looking for more of a potential big time starter for you. But to answer your question, I think the offensive line is so strong. If you're not 100% that Joe Alt's the number one guy, you could trade down and get a like tackle, if Fashanu or Fanu, somebody that is very similar in skill set, and maybe acquire a couple more picks. And teams like the Chargers, even the Cardinals, Titans, could be trade candidates because they need more players than just the one.
Yeah. Again, it's Bears sitting there at 9 as well, which again, that's a trade down spot with what they've done. So again, that's been the big talk, is all these teams. Again, there's a bunch of teams in spots, again, based on the way everybody kind of thinks that the first round is going to go. Are you expecting an extremely active trade frenzied first round this year, really, especially in that top 10, 12 picks?
I think so. I think it really could be. I think the top three stick and take their guys. And I think after that, I think you could really see just kind of what I mentioned with the Cardinals. I think the Cardinals could get out of there for a team that needs a quarterback. I think the Chargers have that potential to do the same thing. Definitely the Titans, if they like multiple tackles, because they put themselves in a position, they have to select a left tackle. You know, even if a Malik Nabers is there, they can't select that player because they don't have a starting left tackle right now to protect their second-year quarterback. I don't care if you bring in a Calvin Ridley and you have DeAndre Hopkins and you have all these great personnel. If you can't block the backside of the quarterback, you're not going to have a lot of success. And they didn't do anything in free agency to correct that. So, you know, they're kind of put themselves in that spot. And that's kind of that trend this year that I talk about that a lot of teams have done. They force themselves into certain picks. But the thing is about that, all the teams around know. So if you're a tackle need team, you're going to trade up to number six ahead of the Titans and select that guy.
Yep.
Because you know they're taking one at seven.
Yeah, that's becomes fun. Some of the fun strategy. Again, you get a pro department involved in evaluating those other rosters. You get those team needs boards up there. And again, more glaring holes where, again, they have to fill this spot right here. They have to have a starter that they dropped at this spot. And again, you probably have to take that guy pretty early. So
I think you got a couple of players there that I think could affect some trades. Like you mentioned, I think Marvin Harrison Jr. is one of them. If somebody trades up to the Cardinals and selects at four, you know, do the Chargers take him at five or does he continue to slide? You know, that kind of thing. And some team may want to come up and take that premium type player. I think Brock Bowers is the other one. I'm a Brock Bowers guy. I think he's a top five player in this draft overall, and he's going to slide a little bit, but is a team going to see that value in that player? And I'm talking about, you know, this is a guy that's a 80 to 100 catch a year guy and I think a playmaker. And if you look at the top teams in the NFL these days, they all have tight ends that can catch. Super Bowl is just a great example of that. So, you know, I think Brock Bowers is another one that teams could come up and try to trade for.
Yep, certainly. So again, let's as we get out of the top 10, again, let's say you get down 15 to 32 and then even into the start of the second round. Again, as a team is sitting there, again, the intensity level for a three-hour first round it's up there. Again, in the draft room, it flies by, it's gone in a blink. Again, second round can really be that way too. So from a scouting director standpoint, from again, somebody that's in there, we're sitting there, we're watching players come off the board. It's kind of going at the way we expect. At least the players are coming off, maybe in whatever order. How are you navigating that, you know, back half of the first round and into the second round?
You know, I think you start to see players that may fall that have great first round value. And especially if you have a high second round pick, where maybe you can get into that back in the first round, you know, trade up. You've already selected your player in the first round. You start to see a player, maybe a Bowers or maybe an offensive lineman that you say he is a plug and play starter day one. And we're sitting at 25, 22 that he started to slide because of the depth at that position. And if you see a potential day one starter, you're gonna look to trade, and then you're getting that fifth year option in that first round. So I think that's a very valuable thing. And as a director, that's one of the things you kind of monitor. And you start to tell the GM, hey, let's consider this. Let's consider coming back up and selecting that player. I remember we did that years ago when D'Angelo Williams, the running back out of Memphis, came out. He was sliding in the draft in the back part of the first round. And we started to really get into deep conversations with every team ahead of us to trade our second round pick to come up and get a D'Angelo Williams because we had him graded so high. We weren't able to make the trade, unfortunately, and he was selected and went on to have a really good career. But, you know, that was a player that we earmarked in that that we were hoped to take in the second round, but we said he's not ever going to get to us. We're going to take him. We're going to jump back into the first round and take him, but we couldn't get that trade done. But I think that's what directors are doing and engaging their GM about that player.
Yeah. Again, I was a part of a Falcon staff that did that with Caleb McGarry. Again, back a few years ago, he was a you know, late first round player that was falling. And then what we were told as scouting staff is it's a drop off after McGarry. There may not be another starting tackle in this draft. You know, we jumped from early second to back up into that first round to grab our second first round pick. And again, Caleb's been a good, solid plug and play starter there at right tackle. And again, exactly what you pointed to, a fifth year player, a player where there's a drop off. Again, your college scouting director knows what the rest of that landscape looks like. Again, it's a big drop off from this player to this player. And again, it's time to go up and get him when you need to find that starter at that position right there. So, again, the top 100 players, again, most teams will say top 100. Yeah, we generally know who those guys are going to be. Top 100, again, it's just kind of a mix and match where a team slots them. You get into the day three of the draft, starting in the fourth round, 4 through 7. That's where, again, team preference and what a team wants, system fit, needs, all those kinds of things factor in. You get to day three. Your college staff, your area guys, your regional guys, national guys probably get a little bit more involved on day three, getting questions, bouncing stuff off of them. Again, how much more does your role as a college scouting director really ramp up on day three just to answer those questions?
I think, you know, day three is scouts day. I love it. I think it's the day that scouts get excited because now they're more involved in this draft. And but I think as a director, what I always tried to do was kind of not only fight for my guys in the room, and I mean my guys being the scouts, who they really liked, who they wanted, who they had a conviction on, who they felt really strongly about, but also look at the board. And I think you have to select players of great value as well. And you can get those in that fourth round. I thought when the draft was just a couple of days and there wasn't as much reshuffling as there is today with a 3-day draft and all that, good scouting groups could steal players in the beginning of those days. And I remember when we took Daquan Jones out of Penn State in the fourth round, Daquan was a player that we had as a late first, early second round grade. And he fell to the fourth round, but we did not need a defensive tackle at that point. But there was a kind of a big talk in that room. And that was not only for myself, but a couple of the scouts are saying the value of this player is so strong. You have to select him. We don't have a need there, but he's going to be an outstanding player for us. And the scout grade was so high. The director grade was so high. Coaches loved him. We had to go away from filling a need at that spot and just take the value of the player, and he's still playing today in year 10 and having a terrific career. So I think sometimes you just have to almost take a different approach sometimes as a director. Sell your guys that you love, fight for your scouts, but also look at the board and make sure that value is being taken.
Yeah. Like, do you remember why he slid? That's so unusual for a quality player at an in-demand position to last that long.
It was such a strong defensive tackle draft that year, and he just kept sliding. A lot of people saw him as a true nose, which I didn't, you know, I thought he was a nose, but he could also be, you know, he could even play some three technique. He really was so versatile along that line. His pass rush skill had not ramped up as much in college as it did on the pro level, but the ability was there. It was just what they asked him to do at Penn State was a little bit different than what we were going to ask him to do with the Titans. He was more of a two-gap rundown player where we were going to ask him to be a not only as a rundown player, but a little bit more of a penetrator and disruptor, not as much as a sack guy, but just push the pocket, be able to kind of change the quarterback's lanes at times. And that's really how he was effective. And he had that athleticism. But, you know, Daquan came in and we were like, this guy's going to start as a rookie. And that was such a great pick at the time because we went with the scouts grade and the coaches liked him. It was real cohesive at that point. But, you know, I think you have to do that. And that's the teams that really do a great job. You know, I think the Eagles have done a great job of that, of getting away from just taking a need position and taking the best player available. I mean, they took two huge defensive tackles back-to-back years, but you see them in other rounds taking players – you know, like a Cam Jurgens, and when they really didn't need an offensive lineman, but they knew Jason Kelce was going to retire at some point. Now he's going to be the starting center. So that's real smart drafting to not only draft for potential needs down the road, but take the best player available.
Yeah, really get into the draft philosophy questions there on day three. Again, where a team's at is always going to dictate some of that. Are we in a win now mode? Do we need, hey, forget the development aspect. We need guys that are going to contribute now, or, hey, we're in a good spot. We got a bunch of starters. We don't really have, hey, we got this really developmental player. Again, it's going to take him 2 years, but he could have that high upside. Again, really get into those conversations on day three as well, which can be fun. Again, before we start to wrap up here, you get through round three. Again, what would you tell people out there that about the undrafted free agent process? Again, most teams are going to have maybe eight to 10 draft picks, and then probably 15 to 20 undrafted free agents. What about that process? Again, speaking to a lot of the agents out there, would you say from a director standpoint?
Relationships. Build those relationships way before the draft. Be honest with the agents ahead of time. If you're a scout, driven by, they're the ones signing the free agents after the draft, make sure you're building those relationships. I thought the best undrafted free agents we ever signed was, as I was honest with the agents, you know, the week before the draft, saying, we're not going to select your player, but if he's not drafted, I want him. He's going to be here. This is the depth chart, going over the depth chart, getting the position coach involved with the player and the agent, expressing exactly how he's going to be used, and making them feel comfortable. Everybody wants to get drafted, but sometimes those putting that player in the right position is so important. So I think getting everybody on the same page. I've been in rooms where it was wild, wild west. You know, scouts were wanting to sign their player just because it was from their area. That's never a good thing. You have to be able to stack the board correctly. And as you select a player in the seven rounds, obviously the need for that position gets a little lessened. But if you don't select a certain position, if you go the whole draft and not take a receiver, well, that in the undrafted free agency, that becomes more of a priority. And you have to put the value on the player. And we would put a money value on every player. And that's what we did. Sometimes we went up, sometimes we went a little bit below, but this is what the value of the player is. And how we rank them by position, I think was real important to be able to have a successful undrafted free agency. Because really, you're looking at trying to get 5 to 7 maybe potential draftable, talented type players. And the rest of them are going to be good camp players. And like Roderick mentioned, maybe an upside player with some development on the practice squad, or maybe play special teams for a year until he develops into that position. Is key, but being able to explain that and why you're selecting the player is important than just taking a body or taking a person.
Oh, absolutely. Before we wrap up, you get to Saturday night, seventh round gets done, undrafted free agents are signed, contracts are out, you got rookie mini camp lined up. How big a breath or how long are you giving yourself until you start thinking about that next year's draft?
You know what? After that Saturday night, I was exhausted. I mean, because I'm orchestrating that whole undrafted free agency. The draft's easy. You select them, and they got to come to you. That undrafted, you're a little bit recruiting, mm-hmm. and you're having to get them and the agent to agree to the contract. And the GM and the head coach and position coaches are breathing down your neck to get these players in. And it's a very exhausting thing. So I'm exhausted. I'm done. Go out to a restaurant after, maybe have a few drinks, that type of thing. Next day, come in, make sure all those contracts got signed, and we're not trying to find one more player. And then you start to think, okay, this is what the depth chart looks like. Probably have a meeting with the coaching staff and general manager and go, hey, we're good here. We don't need anything else. And then there's a flip. My mind starts to flip toward next year and start to get our scouts. I don't really want our scouts thinking about it. But as a director, I'm thinking about next year, really 2 days after the draft.
No rest for the weary, right?
No, because really, I'm done at this point. They don't need me anymore. They need me to start getting on next year's guys. And so, you know, I'm still in the office. I'm watching everything happen. I'm going out to rookie camp, going out to the veteran camp, which is fun to watch players run around that you've selected. But, you know, it's also a time to start getting ready for next year. And then take a little bit of a break in that late May leading up to the meetings that you have, the league meetings that you have in late May.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Well, Blake, this has been fantastic. As everybody probably knows out there, there's going to be 32 ways of doing things come draft time, meetings leading up to it. And again, even from year to year, things are going to change for teams as people take different roles, different GMs, Again, there's no one way to skin a cat. But again, for everybody that comes through the process, you got to think about it. Think about it critically. Think about the decisions made. And one thing that I can promise every fan, every agent, everybody out there, the team knows more than you do. The scouts know more than you do. That building knows more than you do. Again, it's always a really good time not to question the draft pick, but think about the process leading up to the draft pick. Again, educate yourself on that way. Again, it's a really good practice, really good thing to just work through your critical thinking. Because again, assume they know more and try to come up, well, how did they get there? How did they get to this decision? Not so much the decision itself. Again, it becomes a huge, huge factor for the people that really love ball, really love the process. If you have questions coming out of here, head on over to Twitter. Neil is at Inside the League. I'm at Right Step ADV. You can find more information on Neil at InsideTheLeague.com. Make sure you check out his blog, SucceedInFootball.com. RSAFootball.com is where you can find more on me. Before we jump off, let me remind you, check out Agent Live 360, the number one CRM software designed by sports agents for sports agents. Sign up for a demo. We can jump on a call, talk some ball, take a look at Agent Live 360, see all it has to offer. Again, head on over to agentlive360.com. Blake, appreciate you being on.
Hey, this was great. I love talking draft. I love sitting with you guys and discussing it all. It's my favorite time of the year, and I can't wait for Thursday.
Had a blast.
Well, again, no, I'm sure there's going to be no short, stiff, white corners taken. Again, Cooper DeJean's a much better player, corner safety. He's going to get drafted day one, day two. But again, with football, everything that goes on, it is a year-round thing. The transfer portal remains open. Guys continue to move spots. If you haven't checked out some UFL games, again, it's some good competitive games. Again, right as we get past the draft, we'll see some front office movement. But again, the NFL knows how to stay in the spotlight. And again, you as the fans and listeners are part of that. 2024 draft, we're so close. So keep scouting.